Today on Inside Politics, old and out of shape. That's how Joe Biden described Donald Trump's ideas. At a star-studded fundraiser with Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, we have new reporting on the presidential trifecta and the mega millions they're raking in. Plus, a CNN exclusive. A federal judge is weighing in on Donald Trump's attacks on the judge overseeing the former president's hush money case, while warning that Trump's words threaten the viability of the U.S. legal system. And 1 year stolen. A year of stolen stories, stolen joys, stolen memories. That's how the Wall Street Journal is explaining and describing what has happened as it marks the painful one-year anniversary of reporter Evan Gershkovich's wrongful detention in Russia. His apparent crime? Doing his job as a journalist. I'll speak with Evan's publisher this hour. I'm Dana Bash. Let's go behind the headlines and inside politics. First up, a parade of presidents in the Big Apple. Joe Biden is wrapping up his Manhattan visit by speaking to top donors this morning, just hours after he raked in more than $26 million, according to his campaign. That, of course, with the help of his friends who used to sit in the Oval Office. The Biden campaign excluded press and network cameras from the event last night, but released this selected first clip.
Can voters trust a presidential candidate who has not won a single Trump International Golf Club trophy? At long last, sir, have you no chip shot?
Well, look, I'd be happy to play. I told him this before when he came into the Oval, when he was being, before he got sworn in. I said, I'll give you three strokes if you carry your own bag.
CNN's Arlette Sines is at the White House. Says a lot that that is the clip that the Biden campaign, that the White House wants out there.
Yeah, Dana, and the Biden campaign has really made one of their central strategies trying to draw that contrast between Biden and former President Donald Trump. And part of that strategy includes finding ways to needle Trump, as you saw as evident in that clip that the campaign released this morning. President Biden actually continued that as he met with top donors to his campaign at a finance retreat this morning in New York City. And he said, quote, Donald Trump is president in his mind, I'm president. So it really comes as the Biden campaign has been trying to find this ways to tweak Trump as they are making these contrast arguments against him. But as the president right now is meeting with these top donors, those donors are preparing to hear from senior Biden campaign officials like Jen O'Malley Dillon, Mike Donilon, and Julie Chavez Rodriguez about the plans going forward for their strategy and their operations. This morning, we've learned that the Biden campaign is actually launching 30 new offices in the battleground state of Michigan, really trying to present a contrast with the operations with the RNC and Trump, who just yesterday said that they would be opening dozens of offices across battleground states nationwide. So this really comes on the heels of this big fundraiser, $26 million, as they're hoping this event with Biden, Obama, and Clinton will really reinvigorate Democratic voters as they're preparing for that matchup against Trump in November.
Arlette, thank you so much for that reporting. Really interesting about Michigan, especially. Let's talk more about what happened inside that room last night. First, before we discuss with our panel, the Biden campaign, I mentioned they released a first clip. Then they also released another this morning with the president talking about what he believes is at stake in November.
I think our democracy is at stake. Not a joke. I think democracy is literally at stake. We're at a real inflection point in history. Things are changing. All the things he's doing are so old. Speaking of old. And, you know, a little old and out of shape. But anyway.
I want to bring in our panel of great reporters to talk about this. Jackie Kucinich of the Boston Globe, CNN's Jeff Zeleny, and Sungmin Kim of the Associated Press. Happy Friday, everyone. Jeff Zeleny, you covered one of the formers in there for a long time, Barack Obama. And of course, you're covering the Biden campaign. What's your takeaway, sort of big picture, from what we saw last night?
I think the big picture takeaway, once again, trying to send the message that Democrats are unified, which is no small thing. I mean, there are certainly deep concerns over Gaza, over immigration and other things. But the Democratic Party pretty broad-based, is unified around Joe Biden. Yes, there were a few protesters in there, but imagine if he would have had a primary challenge, how he would have gone into this. So I think the strength of the president is one thing the campaign is trying to send the message, again, to get Democrats on board. It's kind of a two-part strategy. Before they get some independents and swing voters, they need to get all Democrats on board, which sort of sounds obvious, but that would lift his approval rating. So, and also just to show that President Biden's okay. He's doing just fine, and side to side with all these sort of, you know, rock stars of the party, that's what it was about. I'm not sure it does anything in the short term to help him with those voters in Michigan, in Georgia, other places, but the money certainly will help by the ads that they think will in turn help them.
I do think it's interesting. You could hear him trying to turn the age issue around in a way, and you've heard him do it once before. I can't remember where, but that my ideas are new. His ideas are old. Like, just really trying to hammer that home. I think that's going to be probably a very a stump speech
for sure.
In the making, what you heard right
there. Yeah, they've been looking for kind of a Reagan-esque way, which is sort of quaint now, considering that Reagan was like 10 years plus younger than Joe Biden is now, and certainly younger than Donald Trump, a Reagan-esque way to turn the age issue on its head. Let's talk about one of the things you mentioned, Jeff, which is the protesters. It was expected. They go everywhere the president goes, and they go everywhere a lot of Democrats go. These are people who are protesting the administration's stance in support of Israel in its retaliatory war in Gaza. Here's, because we have quotes, we don't have video from inside this. This is one of the things that President Biden said. I've been working with the Saudis and with all the other Arab countries, including Egypt and Jordan and Qatar. They're prepared to fully recognize Israel. There has to be a post-Gaza plan, and there has to be a train to a two-state solution.
Right, and he has not only emphasized that several times, he has also emphasized in public several times over how diligently he and his White House are working towards that temporary ceasefire in Gaza to at least give a relief to the fighting, get humanitarian aid in, get hostages out, because he knows, obviously, that's a policy matter that he wants to tackle, but he knows this is a major political matter. He sees the anger. He sees the 100,000 people in Michigan that voted uncommitted in that Democratic state's primary. Right now, the campaign, again, is betting on the fact that not, for example, those 100,000 voters in Michigan, they're not all going to sit home or vote for Trump. I mean, a lot of them told us during that Michigan process that we just want to send a message now because Joe Biden is the one in charge right now. He is the one who can actually do something. So, you know, come November, the campaign is really hoping that when that binary choice is in front of voters, that they make the what they believe would be the proper decision. But it is a gamble, which is why you're seeing the big investment like you're doing in Michigan this morning.
And, you know, it was really interesting to see not just President Biden give a response to those protesters, but his two Democratic predecessors. Barack Obama, who is seen by progressives as maybe more on their side on Israel, and Bill Clinton, who tried like almost to the last day of his presidency to actually find that two-state solution. I just want to read what each of the men said. Obama: when you look at a situation like we're seeing in Gaza and in Israel, and your heart breaks initially for a massacre of unbelievable cruelty, it is also possible for us to say we unequivocally support the people of Israel. Clinton: the world we live in is hard because you have to keep two apparently conflicting ideas in your head. You should trust them to work for it, to work to ease the suffering of the totally innocent Palestinian citizens and not to allow Israel's security to be lost. So to me, the way I saw that was as much about the substance of what they said and also a reminder of the fact that these are two amazing communicators. Amazing community.
Without a doubt. And another president can often explain for you better than you can yourself. We saw that with Bill Clinton, of course, in the Obama reelection. And I think we'll see it again in this reelection as well. But on those issues specifically, and when the event was interrupted by protesters, Barack Obama said something he has said repeatedly on a variety of issues. You can't just talk, you have to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And he always became very frustrated, like when students in his class weren't listening. He sort of strikes that professorial tone. But I think the Bill Clinton words there are so important, perhaps to older voters who really recall him very fondly here. So I think those are also sort of leading the way to another conversation. What would Trump do? Mm-hmm. I mean, what would happen with Gaza if Trump was president? So I think that's a discussion that has been sort of left out of the broader conversation. Yeah. And the protests, okay, this is the season for protesting. Sure. The fall is the season for voting. So we'll see what these protesters do.
I have to, speaking of Bill Clinton, this quote was also interesting. Here's what he said about 2016. He said, "We should not make 2016's mistakes. We should stay with what works and not let people who try to undo it take credit for whatever." Now, what happened? Who ran
in 2016? No, I wonder if he would have said that if his wife was sitting on stage with him, former Secretary of State.
And by the way, I think he would say he as the one of her top surrogates, made some big mistakes.
Right. And I think that it also it shows how much 2016 continues to haunt this race, not only because Bill Clinton is sitting there, but there are echoes of 2016 that Democrats are worried that they have a blind spot, that they're not, that they're somewhere they're not going, that maybe there's some people they're failing to talk to. And that fear, I think, is going to continue, particularly as you see these poll if Biden's poll numbers don't move one way or the other.
That's so interesting and such a good point. And it's a nice segue to the last point in the segment that I want to make. Sungmin, I'm sure we all saw our friend Jonathan Martin's piece this morning, questioning why the Biden campaign has not reached out to Republican, high-profile Republicans who have no intention of voting for Donald Trump. Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, Todd Young, Bill Cassidy all say the same thing. They've not heard from Biden. You know who understands the value of a politician receiving a personal touch, perhaps more than anyone else on the planet? Hint. It's the man who rarely misses a funeral, and so on and so forth.
Right. I thought that piece was so fascinating because it answers sort of the obvious question that's out there. Why hasn't he picked up the phone and called up Susan Collins or Mitt Romney, who are not going to support Trump at the end of the day? Now, the Biden campaign is definitely doing some outreach to those so-called Nikki Haley voters. They actually just released a digital ad a couple hours ago targeting that kind of vote, those kind of voters in those states. But there is a persistent block of voters who are still not supporting Trump in these primaries. That's a ghetto group right there for Joe Biden.
All right, everybody stand by. Coming up, Donald Trump went after the daughter of a judge presiding over his hush money case. And a federal judge talked exclusively to my colleague, Caitlin Collins, about the dangers of that kind of rhetoric. What he said after the break.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Donald Trump has a new target, the daughter of the judge overseeing his hush money case. He's attacking her by name while he's claiming that she is a rabid Trump hater. Now, U.S. District Judge Reggie Walton, an active federal judge, the kind who rarely speaks publicly, is condemning those dangerous comments in an exclusive interview with my colleague Caitlin Collins.
It's very disconcerting to have someone making comments about a judge, and it's particularly problematic when those comments are in the form of a threat, especially if they're directed at one's family. I mean, we do these jobs because we're committed to the rule of law and we believe in the rule of law, and the rule of law can only function effectively when we have judges who are prepared to carry out their duties without the threat of potential physical harm.
My panel is back. I mean, we can't underscore enough how extraordinary and rare it is for a person sitting on the federal bench to come out and comment publicly about the dangers, about anything, but specifically about the dangers of such rhetoric that we're hearing from the candidate on the Republican side.
But this judge and his daughter, this isn't the first time this has happened. I go back to 2016, Judge Curiel, who was in charge of the Trump University case, was absolutely put center stage by the former president, received threats, all of these things. Reuters did a great piece at the end of February about a lot of the judges that have handled some of these Trump cases and what they have endured. And they had this stat that I thought really stood out. That was, since Trump launched his campaign in 2015, threats against judges, federal prosecutors, et cetera, has tripled, according to the U.S. Marshals Service. So this isn't an accident. This is what he does.
And you heard the judge mentioning to Caitlin, he's a very experienced judge, and just since some of the January 6th cases have been going through, there have been so many more threats in his entire career. So the reason this matters is, and these aren't just happening because Trump is often calling out these judges by name on social media. That reverberates through the right-wing sort of echo chamber on radio and social media, et cetera. So then it becomes an issue. And what's different about this, you know, no one is necessarily responsible for the threats of their supporters that they give out, but there's no calling people back. There's never been anyone, Trump specifically, saying, don't do this. So no calming of the rhetoric. He, in fact, does the opposite.
Yeah, you're being
stirred up.
Yeah, I mean, he said this judge's daughter's name by name. He knows what he's doing. He was around for January 6th. We all know what happened or didn't happen on January 6th. I'm going to switch gears, staying on the Trump campaign. Our colleague Stephen Collinson had another one of his wonderful pieces this morning, and the headline was, Trump is a ringmaster of multiple sideshows as Biden cranks up pace of reelection bid. And I'll read just a bit of Stephen's article. Donald Trump is running one of the strangest general election campaigns America has ever seen. He's hawking Bibles, attacking judges, making billions in the stock market, and boasting about his golf game. Trump has always been an outlier, and his refusal to play by the rules of a normal campaign is the key to his political appeal among supporters who despise governing elites. That last part, we cannot ever forget.
Right.
That the way that he is campaigning, the people who support him or even inclined to support him, they're just fine with it.
Right, right. The problem for the Trump campaign is that there's a ceiling to the percentage of voters who would be attracted to that kind of campaigning, that kind of style. And what's interesting about that whole dynamic is that the Biden campaign so far is doing all the things that you think a good presidential campaign should be doing. They're raising gobs of money. They are opening tons of offices in battleground states. They are well ahead of the Trump campaign on that front. And I think the big question that we probably won't be able to answer until Election Day is whether those traditional campaign metrics actually matter in this day and age, not only in this day and age, but when you're running against such an unorthodox candidate like Trump. I do think there is some worry coming out of Republicans and Trump campaign right now, considering the pace of the fundraising and the organizational advantages coming out of the Biden camp. I mean, Trump campaign officials are saying, we will have dozens of offices open up soon. We will raise tons of money, especially at this Palm Beach fundraiser. I believe that's next week. We'll see how much they speed up, but certainly they are at a disadvantage right now in those fundamental metrics.
One person who we have not seen very much of at all until recently when Trump went to vote in the Republican primary in Florida is his wife, Melania Trump. And our colleague, Sunlin Sarfati, has another great piece on CNN.com about where she is. Here's what Sunlin reports. She'll definitely have a role, but in terms of what it is, I don't know, a source close to the Trump campaign said. It's her decision on how much or how little she will be campaigning. She is very selective and methodical in what she wants to do and how she presents herself. As I bring you in to talk about this, our team found a nugget of sorts. And this is an interview that Trump did with Megyn Kelly back in September of 2023.
Well, I think part of the beauty is that mystery. She is much more, you know, she's introspective and she's confident. She doesn't need to be interviewed by you to get ripped apart for no reason. She doesn't need to be out there.
I mean, it's an unconventional campaign, and this is another part of it. But it's been, this is how Melania Trump was as first lady, right? She did what she wanted. She showed up when she wanted. Mm-hmm. She was out there when she wanted. And it doesn't seem like anything has changed going into the second campaign.
And we're about to have a very uncomfortable a case from the early stages of their marriage, the Stormy Daniels case, which she has talked privately about as being very, a very painful moment. So you have to wonder if that is part of it as well, that staying out of the limelight as that case goes through. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure this matters electorally, if she was out campaigning or not. But you do wonder if the shoe was on the other foot, if another spouse was not out, if Michelle Obama had not been out, if Jill Biden is not. I think there would be some questions here. But as you said, unconventional.
All right, guys, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Up next, 365 days wrongfully detained in Russia. Where things stand for American journalist Evan Gershkovich since he was arrested on Russia espionage charges, how his family, friends, and colleagues are working very hard for his release. Next. A year ago today, Russian agents detained Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich. Since that day, Evan spends 23 hours a day in a small cell in a Moscow prison. He's there because of charges of espionage, charges that Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal, the U.S. government vehemently deny. Today, President Biden is vowing to keep pushing to get Gershkovich back. He said in a statement, "To Evan, to Paul Whelan, and to all Americans held hostage for wrongfully detained abroad, we are with you and we will never stop working to bring you home." Today, the Wall Street Journal is making the grim anniversary very stark by leaving the front page blank. The headline, "His story should be here." With me now is the publisher of the Wall Street Journal and the CEO of Dow Jones, Almar Latour. Thank you so much for being here. Let's start with the activity that is going on to get Evan home. What can you tell us about where those efforts are?
Well, throughout this rather disturbing year, there's been lots of activity, seen and unseen, and there've been ups and downs. I think we hope that this will come to a crescendo in the time ahead. We're in a critical period now for Evan because we expect a bogus trial to start in the next few months in Russia, a secret trial at that. And there's a period between now and then when I believe we should push as hard as we possibly can, and the administration should push as hard as it possibly can for his release, to try to get to a deal. If not by that date, that might set in motion another cycle of time, the duration of a trial, which if you look at spy trials throughout history in Russia, that could add a significant amount of time to Evan's incarceration. So we're filled with hope today. It was a very emotional day, obviously, here at the Journal today. But there's also a sense of urgency, more resolved than ever before.
Wall Street Journal editor, editor-in-chief Emma Thompson told our colleague Oliver Darcy that she expects him to be home this time next year. I'm sure that is your hope, that your hope it is tomorrow, not this time next year. What is your sense of that? And as you answer that, and I understand that you need to be cautious because these are very delicate talks, but do you feel comfortable that the Biden administration is doing enough to help in your efforts to free Evan?
I have no doubt that the Biden administration and the people surrounding it have all the right intent, and they have devoted a lot of time and attention to getting this deal done. But the outcome is binary. He's either free or he's not, and that's the report card that we have to give ourselves, and also to the Biden administration. I think they are pushing, but until Evan is free, it's still not enough.
Yeah, of course. I want to widen the aperture a little bit, if I may. And as I do, I'm going to hold up. I actually have an old school newspaper here, which shows what we showed at the beginning of the segment, a blank page here, which was very powerful, very well done by the Wall Street Journal, saying his story should be here. Next to it, of course, is a story about what he lost in the year that he has been detained, both personally, most importantly personally, but also professionally. And when I say I want to widen the aperture, talk about Evan's case and how it illustrates the dangers that journalists worldwide have when they try to report on autocratic regimes, and what it means about the importance of reporting on these autocratic regimes.
Yeah, first that last part, right? We need to understand globally what goes on in autocratic regimes, how freedom is repressed, and all the negative consequences for citizens of those countries. I think that's a global theme. And the only way to find out about that really is through reporting on the ground. And so that at this very moment in time, when there's so many countries moving in an autocratic direction, it's probably more important than ever. And so the dangers that are associated with that are also greater than ever before, in my view. You can see that in the numbers. There are more reporters incarcerated. Russia is a hotspot for this. There are, I believe, over a dozen foreign journalists detained. The climate against the free press in Russia under Putin over the last 2 years has gotten worse and worse and worse, and is at a very intense stage there right now.
Yeah, and I think what you just said is so critical. First and foremost, it is about Evan and his safety, his well-being, getting him home to his family, but also about how dangerous it is that there is a regime like what we see in Russia, and how much of an illustration it is about what could happen when the freedom of the press and freedom to go in and explain and tell the world about what is happening in a government, which sometimes we take for granted here, what happens when that freedom is taken away. Thank you so much. We are thinking about Evan. We are thinking about all of his colleagues at The Wall Street Journal and, of course, his family today. Appreciate you coming on.
All right. Thank you, Dana, and thank you for your support.
Thank you. And up next, John King went to the southern border in the swing state of Arizona to ask voters there what they think about immigration, and their answers may surprise you.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
In his latest installment of All Over the Map, CNN's John King traveled to Arizona to talk to voters about what they think about the critical issues, especially the border.
A wall as far as the eye can see. This is the Tucson sector, by far the busiest corridor for illegal border crossings. Smuggling is a big problem, and a big business, Faith Ramon, knows all too well.
I needed money. I needed money quick. And because of my alcohol and my addiction, I just went to a party, met some friends. They offered me some quick money. I took it. And it was so easy. It was so easy. I did it again, and I did it again. Sure enough, I was doing it for years because of it being so easy.
Then you got caught.
And then I got caught. My luck ran out.
A felony conviction set Ramon in search of sobriety. And a 2018 Tohono O'odham tribal ritual would again put the border front and center.
A sweat lodge ceremony. And I walked in, and that was the very first time I heard that there was a border wall that was going to be built on the reservation, separating and destroying some of our sacred sites.
Ramon is now an activist who registers voters and is eligible to have her own voting rights restored.
Thank you, Mama.
Her first choice for president would be this November in Battleground, Arizona.
I will vote for Biden.
Donald Trump is not an option.
I don't like the fact that our reservation was destroyed by a racist wall.
To win here again, Biden needs big margins here in South Central Arizona, Tucson, and south to the Mexican border. Air Force veteran Melissa Cordero voted for Trump in 2020.
I was a small business owner at the time.
Cordero works for a conservation nonprofit now and will not vote for Trump again.
Reproductive rights, you know, as someone who was raped, sexually assaulted, I had the opportunity to make that decision on terminating a pregnancy. I can't imagine in future years to come, if that happens to me again or to somebody else, them not having that.
Likely Biden, but Cordero will study third-party options.
You know, my biggest issue with Biden is the Palestine issue. You know, you fight for queer, trans, BIPOC, immigrant, access to vote, veterans being deported, access for veterans to vote while they're overseas. You know, then also you just should care if people are getting killed at that rate.
Ray Flores is no fan of Biden or Trump, thinks both are too old to be president.
At this juncture, they both had 4 years, and I'm just 8 years more frustrated than I was before.
Flores runs El Charro, a family business for 102 years, a Tucson landmark famous for carne seca and the chimichanga. Washington's immigration paralysis hurts business.
I mean, a clear process for work visas would be amazing. If you're a technology company, you can get an engineer and you can get them immigrated and you can get a work visa. Why shouldn't I be able to do that with a chef or with a really good waiter?
The immigration conversation tends to be different in places at or near the border. More polite, more nuanced, focused on solutions, not slogans. So how
long it's a unique situation where you have two countries that create a community, and actually it's mutually beneficial for both countries.
Walk through the Nogales border crossing and the first business you see is Corey's Bridal Shop. Evan Corey is fine with the wall, but didn't like it when Trump added the razor wire. He bristles when the former president talks about the border and Mexicans.
We've always depended on our Mexican neighbors to support our local economy.
Corey, a Democrat, also bristles, though, when liberals oppose more money for the Border Patrol and other security measures.
Yeah, I mean, that's equally frustrating, too, because you have to have a balance between all the needs and find a way to somehow work together.
Handmade boots are a specialty at David's Western Wear. For 44 years, a favorite of customers on both sides of the border. David Moore says 99% of his business was from Mexico before the COVID shutdown. It's about 70% now. Moore says the wall helps stop illegal crossings. He wants more agents to cut long wait times that discourage Mexicans from making day trips to shop. And he says the asylum process is broken.
Yeah, I don't know how that works, that people from Africa are coming in through Mexico, up through the Mexican border. I would want them to regulate that a little more.
Moore is a registered Republican, but a likely Biden voter because Trump offends him.
He said that, you know, the immigrants are poisoning our blood. What would you say?
I'd say my mother was born in Mexico, and she came across the border legally. So, you know, that's poison I can deal with, I guess.
Moore says the way Trump and allies talk about the border is exaggerated and alarmist, and he says he pays the price. Customers call and say they're worried about making the trip to Nogales.
People from everywhere do that, because when they say on the news that the borders are a war zone, you know, those are the images they get. They think it's unsafe, but...
Your home's not a war zone.
My home is not a war zone. No, we've been here for a long time.
A long time at what is now a major line of America's political divide.
So great. First of all, you should have gotten one of those hats for Beyonce Day, but yeah, we'll talk about that in a second. The fact that the arguments and the discussions are so nuanced, solutions, not slogans, you can hear the frustration in the voices of those people you talk to, that doesn't translate when it comes to our politicians, because they're trying to stir up hate and fear.
They live it every day. You ask them their favorite restaurant, most of them tell you it's across the border in Mexico. And they like to go across to have lunch, and they meet their neighbors and the friends and their customers who come across the border. Because the Border Patrol is so stretched thin now, what used to take 20 minutes can take up to 3 or 4 hours. So you can't do that because there are wait lines at the border. These are their neighbors. They're their friends. Evan Corey, who runs the wedding shop, during COVID, when the Mexicans couldn't come across, he would hold up dresses at the wall. And customers on the other side would pick them out. He would have employees come out and model them at the wall so they could sell them to the neighbors across the place. They want to have a conversation about immigration. Most of them support the wall, even the Democrats. Most of them want more Border Patrol, even the Democrats. They want the asylum process fixed. They just think the politicians just keep shouting, not doing anything.
And that was another thing that really did strike me, the asylum process. Yes, that there are their neighbors, the people who live and work there, their lives, their businesses really depend on it. But there's a whole different question.
Stop legal immigration, fix the legal processes. That's what they want. It's pretty common sense.
Fantastic piece. Thank you so much. Ahead, a candid new interview. I mean, would you expect anything different? Because it's Larry David, and he sat down with CNN's Chris Wallace. I mean, just wait to see what he said about the Republican candidate for president.
Sir, in the navy blazer, put your hands in the air.
Me?
Yeah, you. You under arrest for violation of the Election Integrity Act.
What? What are you talking about?
It is illegal for anyone in the state of Georgia to provide food or water to voters in line at the polls.
What? That's barbaric. What kind of law? Are you serious?
So good. That, of course, was a clip from Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David's iconic series, which has been making us laugh since 2000. Really, 2000? That long? It's in its final season right now. Larry David sat down with the man you saw there, Chris Wallace, on his Mac show, Look Who's Talking. Sorry, Who's Talking to Chris Wallace?
That's
who's
right. Not Look.
There's no
exactly.
Look. I look at it, but it's Who's Talking to Chris Wallace.
And it's on right now, so people can
Max,
watch this as soon
right
as this show is over.
Yeah, don't do it right now.
No,
wait
1 o'clock.
Thank you. Let's play a little bit of your interview with Larry David.
So how much has the whole 2020 election and everything that has flowed from it pissed you off?
Oh, I mean, you can't go a day without thinking about what he's done to this country, because he's such a little baby that he's thrown 250 years of democracy out the window by not accepting the results of an election. I mean, it's so crazy. He's such a sociopath. He's so insane. He just couldn't admit to losing. And we know he lost. He knows he lost. And look how he's fooled everybody. He's convinced all these people that he didn't lose. He's such a sick man. He's so sick. Anyway, no, it hasn't impacted me at all.
La, as I call him, like Susie Essman calls him. I mean, really, I'm sure you talked about other things besides politics, but that was gold.
Well, first, gold, like in Jerry, this is gold. First of all, that's why we talk politics, is because, as you saw from the clip from Curb, this season is built around the fact, the insanity of the Georgia law, where there's a woman online in the heat. He goes up to her. She's a friend. And she says, I'm so thirsty. And he says, and gives her a bottle of water. And he gets arrested because that's the law in Georgia if you're waiting online to vote. No, we talk about a lot of other things. Obviously, what annoys him. I had sent him a thank you note after a dinner we had. Capital offense.
To say thank you or to do a note?
To me to send a note. He, in fact, then had to send me a note back to say to me, don't expect a thank you note the next time we go out to dinner. We also talked about how long you can say Happy New Year. Uh-huh. And he's actually now changed it from 7 days to January 7th to January 3rd. And then he said, and happy birthdays. Guess what? I don't want happy birthday notes. How about that? So we talk about a lot of stuff.
You had me until the birthday thing. I think birthdays are important to celebrate.
Yes, but what he's saying is you send me a debt. Now I've got to send a note back. And he says, you know, it's a nightmare.
So your interview was basically a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode.
Honestly, my staff is going nuts because I have channeled Larry David, and I find myself talking like Larry David. They are so tired of me this week. They want this week to be over and hope that I don't know that they hope I go back to normal, but just not be Larry David, Chris Wallace.
But, you know, I first of all, I love the show. I love him. I think he's a genius. On the politics that you're talking about and the way that this season starts with what happened in Atlanta, the way that it develops and the satire and what they do with the ramifications, let's say. I don't want to give it away for people who haven't seen it, of what started with that arrest.
Well, he even gets a mugshot, and of course, it looks exactly like the Trump mugshot.
Exactly. And, I'll let you do the spoilers.
He's having a good time with this, but this is not. He's got two more episodes this season. It's two more episodes this series in a couple of weeks. The it's over, and I said to him, I mean, is this it? He said, a Sherman-esque statement. I will not do another episode of Curb after this.
Thank goodness it's all streaming. You know what else is streaming? Who's Talking to Chris Wallace?
That's right, and you can see at 1 o'clock, and we're getting closer.
That's right. A new episode stream every Friday on Max. Thank you so much for being here. That's it for Inside Politics. Please join me on State of the Union this Sunday. I'll be talking to Georgia Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock and others. CNN News Central starts after a break.